Welcome to the Ancient Christian Writers series, led by Father David Abernethy at the Oratory of St. Philip Neri in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The following recording is a reading and discussion of the ascetical homilies of St. Isaac the Syrian. Our ability to provide podcasts free of charge is made possible by the generosity of listeners like you. If you would like to make a contribution in support of our ministries, please visit www.thepittsburghoratory.org. Your interest and prayerful support are appreciated. God bless you and enjoy the podcast.
Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Okay, welcome back to the Ancient Christian Writer series, and we're picking up with our reading of the ascetical homilies of St. Isaac the Syrian, and we're currently reading homily 64. And tonight we're starting on page 451, if you're following along in the text, and we're at the top of the page with the paragraph that begins, "When the good order of the knights discipline." And again, this is the longest homily within the text itself. And he's about to move into a section on silence. And then the whole next homily is on silence as well, and with sort of a mixture of his discussion on the nature of mercy. But within this last page in this section of the homily, he'll be talking about things like prolonged stillness, wisdom in our kinds of disciplines, so we don't weaken ourselves too much and become ill in the ascetical life. Our willingness to acknowledge our weaknesses before God. So if we make certain gains in the spiritual life by a deepening of our prayer life and we see the fruit of that, we don't want to fall into a kind of conceit or fall into the snare of the devil into thinking that somehow these gains are due to our own will and our own strength, that they come to us by the grace of God. And so not giving credit to ourselves, in other words, is what he'll be talking about here in the next few paragraphs. And so again, we're at the top of page 451. When the good order of the knight's discipline is disturbed, then during the labor of the day, the mind also becomes confused. It travels in darkness, and it does not take delight in reading, as it is accustomed to do. For whether it is moved to prayer or to study, confusion assails its thoughts like a hurricane. The delight given to ascetics by day pours forth upon their pure mind from the light obtained by their night's activity. For a man who has not gained experience of prolonged stillness, do not expect to learn anything further about the good things of asceticism, even if he is a great sage and a teacher, having many achievements behind him. So it's an interesting line of thought here, because we might not be used to thinking about night vigils or breaking the night as actually helping us to focus during the day. For most of us, I think we would experience the opposite, that we would think that, okay, if I break my night for prayer and spiritual reading, my next day is going to be ruined, that I won't be able to focus on anything that is important, I won't be able to do my work. Whereas in a sort of a counterintuitive way, we're hearing from Isaac here that the labors of the night bring a kind of delight to the soul, but also clarity to the mind. And so during the day then, there is a greater clarity about the things that we're experiencing, the temptations that we might experience throughout the course of the day, that we're able to also engage in spiritual reading in the day with a greater clarity and delight as well. That there's something about the deep and long kind of stillness and prayer that actually brings a lingering focus throughout the course of our day. And again, this is something that is only comes through experience. And I think that's why he says what he does at the very end of the paragraph. From one who has not gained experience of prolonged stillness, do not expect to learn anything further about the good things of asceticism. That is only through actually engaging in this practice and the asceticism as a whole with a kind of exactness over the course of many years, then can one begin to teach about it? And especially in regards to stillness and the fruit that, that brings to the mind and the heart as well. If you jump ahead to page 466 in the text, down to about the fourth paragraph, it's along the same vein here, in the similar kind of thought. He says, "And again, how greatly does vigil by its wakefulness, together with prayer and reading, cause delight, gladden, rejoice, and cleanse the soul. This is known preeminently by those who practice these things throughout the whole of their lives and struggle in strict and exacting asceticism." So the wakefulness, the spiritual wakefulness at night, brings a kind of wakefulness during the day so that we are have a clarity and sharpness in the face of temptations that might come to us. There's a humbling, yes, of the mind and the body that takes place through the practice of vigils, but that prolongs itself into the next day during our waking hours in order that we might be able to engage in the spiritual life more fully. Our tendency during the day perhaps would be to face greater distractions from the world around us and so be pulled away from our attentiveness to God and remembrance of God throughout the course of the day, as well as attentiveness to what's going on within our own minds and hearts and how we might be drawn away from God through our thoughts. And so being humbled in mind and body at night, engaging in spiritual reading, experiencing a kind of delight that comes through that prolonged stillness and communion with God, then allows us in the course of the day to maintain that kind of humbled and attentive spirit, and also to experience a kind of joy and delight in God Himself. Whereas if we allow ourselves to have a kind of excess of sleep and we neglect this kind of prolonged prayer, we'll never come to experience what he's talking about here, a kind of a joy, deep focus, delight in God throughout the course of the day. And so I'm not counseling people here. I don't want people to walk away from the group and say, okay, you have to have 3 hours of prolonged stillness during the night. I think that's why in the next paragraph he warns about being indiscriminate in our disciplines. We don't want to fatigue and wreck the body in the process of our spiritual life. But I think it's good for us at least to have within our mind and to be thinking about, at least thinking about the practice of vigils and how that might be incorporated into our life in some measure. That we have a consistent spiritual tradition that is telling us that this bears a unique and special and enduring fruit for us and helps us to deal with temptations throughout the course of the day and helps us to be mindful of God. And so, and it's also a part of monastic life, East and West. And so how is it that we, living in the world, incorporate this kind of wisdom and simplify our lives or structure our lives in such a way that either periodically but regularly have this as part of our spiritual life? So we could ask ourselves that about just about anything that we've been reading in this book that we might only do episodically, fasting and you know, other forms of spiritual practices that he talks about here. But sleep, I think, is the more challenging one for us. And it's because I think we have this thought in our mind that we'll weary ourselves. We don't have the experience or the trust, perhaps, to believe that there is a kind of renewal and strengthening that comes through this particular ascetical practice that would actually strengthen us during the day. You know, our judgment of it is typically through those days when we suffer from insomnia and so wake up the next day and feel that we can't function. So it's not really that we've had the experience of prolonged stillness during the night where we're praying and focused upon God. And it's out of that communion that one experiences this strengthening of the soul. And I think that's why he says, you know, you really want to have someone who has a long experience of this and a kind of exacting practice of it to teach you about it and to help you enter into the practice, and not only this practice, but the ascetical life as a whole. Because there are pitfalls to it and struggles that go along with it. Same thing with fasting. There can be difficulties with that, how to begin, the moderation that is needed, how prayer is needed. We need to link prayer to the fasting, how the body responds physiologically to it, and when the hunger pangs. And, you know, it's someone who has a lived experience of that who's going to be able to teach it. And teach it well. And the same is true for night vigils as well. You want someone who would have more of a long experience of that, who can speak of the intricacies of it and also some of the struggles of it as well. But anything about this paragraph or about vigils or, yes?
From once now, if I wake up during the evening, I will listen to a St. Isaac podcast.
It'll put you right back to sleep.
That too. And I wake up totally refreshed and energized without any issues. And for me, it works.
That's good. I'll have to try that. I've never actually listened to one, so I'm not quite sure. Yes?
I think it's interesting what you said, though, on the insomnia comment, because as someone who wakes up at night frequently, usually from my kids. It is true. Like, I read this paragraph and I'm like, if I woke up any more than I did, I might not be able to move the next
I'll be
day.
Dead.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I mean, that is, it, but it's exactly the same thought that you just said about right. Our only experience with it is that, right? Or something else, you know?
Or
like when you're in college, you're studying all night long.
That's right. Or an experience like the one you mentioned, waking up with your kids, but often that will be disconnected for us from prayer. That, you know, we sort of wake up in a daze. Well, I'm not speaking from experience here, so. But you wake up in a daze and go to their bedroom to see what's, you know, going on with them and then to comfort them. But, you know, at those times when we are awakened at night or we just happen to wake up, the thought doesn't necessarily come to mind too, that there's a reason behind that and that we would engage in prayer in those moments, that we wouldn't think, oh, just, can't get back to sleep and be focused on that and struggling, you know, with all of our might to get back to sleep, rather than seeing that as a providential moment to engage in prayer and not to be anxious about waking, but to allow ourselves to turn our thoughts to God at that moment. And we talked a little bit about this in the past, about how sleep schedules differed in like agricultural societies and when they would follow sort of the daylight. You know, then sundown would be basically when people would go to bed because they didn't have electric lights. And then they would wake sort of in the middle of the night, even be up for a couple of hours, and then go back to bed for another period of sleep. And we've moved completely away from that, obviously, because of the advent of electricity and the, you know, the our work day, how it goes now, and so that whole experience has become foreign to us. And so perhaps we've lost something also then of this idea of breaking the night that might have been more of a regular thing for them. And I imagine even like heating the house, one would probably have had to do that in the middle of the night, wake up and stoke the fire or something along those lines, that there were probably essential realities of day-to-day life that required them to do that, sort of like waking up to take care of the kids. And so how does one do this in the world? And I would think about it along these terms, you know, that maybe even beginning to look at our sleep patterns in a different way. And even before seeking to begin a practice of this, even in the most measured way, of looking at our own experience of what it is to wake up in the middle of the night. You know, does that fill us with frustration or panic or about the next day, or is it the moment where we can be recollected? You know, do we take hold of the tchotchke, the prayer rope, or our rosary, and begin to pray during that time, and until perhaps we would drift off again? And so to see it again more of in a providential kind of way. And I think that, experiences like that could open us up to have more of a generosity of spirit toward the idea of vigils, that when we begin to experience on some small level the fruit of that, that certainly a person waking up in the middle of the night who's maybe even having trouble sleeping, who, even gets up for a little bit and maybe sits in the chair next to the bed or something like that, engages and says a prayer rope and then goes back to bed, it's likely that the next day for them is going to start off differently than if they were just filled with anxiety about not being able to get to sleep. If they use that time to engage God in, a spirit of intimacy. And there are ways, I think, for us then to begin to incorporate the discipline, in terms of simplifying our lives. Sometimes we will artificially prolong our days, even if we're free to go to bed earlier in order that we might rise early, or if we're free to pray longer, say end of the night, and then get up at a certain time. We won't often use that time well, that we'll artificially prolong the day by lingering in work. Things that we tell ourselves, well, if I just do this more this day, then I'll be freer at another time. Or we'll stay up and want to psychologically get away from the stresses of the day. And so we'll artificially prolong the day, even though we're fatigued and probably could go to sleep in order to wake up earlier, that we'll artificially prolong the day in order to have that feeling of freedom from the stress of the day, whether it's watching YouTube or Netflix or something along those lines. I think that's become more of a struggle in our day because we have, this constant access to movies and videos with even our phones. Now, who would have ever thought of such a thing? But it allows us to do that with greater ease. I think in the past, people would have just gone to bed at a certain time, but now, we can prolong it, and unless we're very clear in our own mind about not doing that and establishing the disciplining ourselves, turning off the electronics early, getting ourselves ready for bed through prayer. And he'll talk about that a little bit further, how important that time right before sleep is for us. But this is the kind of a discipline that we first, I think, have to engage in order to even lay the foundation. How is it we look at our day, the use of our time? What are the patterns of behavior that might preclude our engaging in this kind of practice? It's a habit of mind and a habit of practice that sometimes can be hard to break because we think that we need it psychologically, just to get past the day or to prepare ourselves for the next day. I need to linger in this distraction. And, what we find clearly from Isaac is that there's part of us that has to learn to be able to set those kinds of distractions aside, as hard as it is for us to do that, and to reestablish a life that is focused upon God. And more intently over time to open up the space for this. And we might even have to force ourselves to do that, force ourselves to pray even when we don't feel like it, and whether it's in the middle of the night or before bed. Okay, any further thoughts or comments on this? Yes.
I guess the thing that occurred to me, I'm definitely not at the vigils point yet, but it does seem like the sleep is such a major part of our lives that it seems like a pretty big mistake to not to some degree order it towards God. Mm-hmm. It's having a third of your life, right, is just by default separated from, mm-hmm, that basic orientation, right, would seem to be a pretty big problem.
Right. I think so. You know, we already know that, like, the light from electronics in our room can have a negative effect, even if we're not, like, watching the our phone or iPad or something like that, that can keep us from going to sleep. But say if we do have the television on, you know, we're in this constant state of receptivity. And so if we're going to sleep with the television, this is sort of the last thing that we're hearing as we're drifting off. So this is what is filling our consciousness and what we're allowing to fill our consciousness. And we have to wonder what effect over time that has on us, as opposed to really becoming disciplined in that period before sleep to, you know, engage in a kind of night prayer or to say the Jesus prayer, and even to drift off to sleep while saying the Jesus prayer. You know, that we've talked before about, you know, how the monks often knew how deeply ingrained the prayer had become when the last thing on their mind and on their lips was the Jesus prayer, and then they would wake up saying it. You know, their lips would be moving, and that's how you would know that the prayer has really taken root very deeply within the heart. And if we're doing something like falling to sleep with a television, we might be waking up thinking about what we were watching the night before. And so already there, we're abstracted from God, you know, who we want to be the focus of our life, the beginning and the end of all things. And so often for us, the beginning and the end of all things is the television. You know, what do a lot of people do the first thing when they wake up? They get their coffee and they turn on the television to watch the news. And so, and at night, they drift off to sleep watching the news or the late show or whatever it might be. So the beginning and the end is not the Lord of the heavens, but our Lord the television. So any other thoughts? Okay. He goes on to say, be on your guard, moreover, not to exhaust your body completely, lest lethargy gain strength against you and chill your soul to the savor of her work. It behooves every man to weigh his discipline as though on the scales. At a time when you have taken your fill, be on your guard for a while against being free with yourself. Let your sitting be in chastity, at the time of your bodily need. But most of all, be chaste and pure when you are going to sleep, and be closely observant, not only of your thoughts, but also of your members. Beware of conceit at the time of changes toward the good. In your prayer, earnestly show the Lord your weakness and your unskillfulness before the subtlety of conceit, lest you be given up to be tempted in shameful things. For fornication follows upon pride, and upon conceit, delusion. So a lot in this one paragraph here. So he warns not to weaken the body too much, because then we can lose our zeal, the necessary zeal to engage in the spiritual life. And so if we weaken ourselves too much with fasting, or if we don't give ourselves any sleep, obviously we're not only not going to be able to function in our daily work, but we're not going to be able to engage in the spiritual life with full attentiveness, but a kind of joyfulness and buoyancy. And so we are to weigh the disciplines in the scales. And so this is why we hear from the fathers, moderation is what we would want in the spiritual disciplines, avoiding excesses on either end of the scale. So not falling into excess, but not falling into a kind of lethargy or neglect. And then here he begins to talk about when we've had our fill, you know, when we've engaged in this life of prayer and press for a long period of time, and we rise from that to attend to our bodily needs, that we don't want to let go of our attentiveness, that engaging in attending to our need for food or bathing or, I don't know what else, getting dressed or whatever it might be, that we would not want those moments to be for us, just moments when we become oblivious to what's going on in our mind or the thoughts that we are having. And if we think about it, often those days are, that's like a void. Those times are like a void for us, that we go about doing them, you know, getting dressed in the morning or fixing a meal or eating the meal with not kind of recollection, not being attentive to God. Monasteries understood this well, you know, that they would eat their meals in silence and there would be reading going on while they were eating in order that they might maintain the connection between the chapel and the refectory. And so they would typically read something from scripture, and then there would be a reading, say, from the martyrology. So stories from, you know, the saints of the days or the martyr of the day, and then maybe some longer reading from the roll or from some spiritual work like this that they would be reading at the meal. And so throughout the entire meal, they would be able to maintain that focus and that sense of being recollected. And I know for parents, it's hard sometimes. I remember my sister first had her kids, and I'd go out to visit, and meals were like hell. You know, it was like everybody would eat really fast because you didn't know how long the kids were going to be good, you know, before one of them would like burst into tears or start screaming or something like that. So you find yourself unnaturally speeding up the eating. And I thought, you know, this isn't, I'd go out there for my day off. You know, I think this isn't very restful, you know, like swallowing my meal here whole just to get through it before something happens at the dinner table. And so, you know, I think, and it's certainly not parents only with young children, but I think typically there can be a lot of distraction that we have. And again, that we even purposely bring into those moments. The advent of the television, I think, probably ruined the sense of communion that existed in families, of eating a common meal together and engaging each other. Companions, you know, to break bread with is the meaning of the word. And so there is to be a kind of essential communion that exists at the table together. And we're eating a common meal, common, you know, the same food, and then we're having a discussion, you know, typically about something. And with the television, you know, it's the meals sometimes even moved out of the dining room or the kitchen into the living room itself to sit in front of the television, or the television would be brought to the dinner table. And so nobody's engaged with everybody. Everybody's engaged in this virtual kind of reality. And you think over time, you know, what effect has that had upon the intimacy of the family? That even the kind of stillness or silence, not, you know, silence like the monastery, but sort of just the quietness of the family meal, when that breaks down so much, you know, how do they begin to experience that intimacy with each other any longer? You know, times that would be the most important time of the day, you know, especially if the father's out at work and, you know, mom's taking care of the kids all day, and then, you know, it's that common meal. And, or the Sunday meal would sort of be the extension of that, where the whole extended family would get together. And I think we've sort of lost that entirely. You know, it's gone with the past generation in large part. And so, you know, getting back to the text, I think what Isaac at least opens our eyes to is that the things that we take for granted every day, we almost need to be more attentive to these things because they are such a part of the norm of day-to-day life, that that's where we can become vulnerable. So when we're getting ready for bed and getting into bed is often a time when a person is overcome with temptation. And because they let down their guard, they're getting tired, and they're perhaps drifting, you know, out of consciousness, they're starting to fall asleep. And so the passions can begin to loom at that point. And the next thing, you know, they're led into you know, sexual sin or simply into fantasy of some form or another. And so he says, fornication follows upon pride. So, you know, when we let go of that vigilance, where we think that we don't need to be vigilant, you know, that this won't happen to me, or I'm past that, you know, that's when a person falls. The proverb says, pride rideth before the fall. So, you know, as soon as a jockey gets cocky on the top of the horse, you know, and starts playing around, is where he falls headlong off the horse and gets wounded. Same is true for all of us. You know, when we let down our attentiveness and let go of the sense that, you know, we have to be attentive to our passions that can be unwieldy and sort of cast us, you know, off of the path that we would desire to be on. And so especially at these moments, and that's why the fathers would often say in the morning, you leap out of bed like it's a bed of hot coals. So as soon as it, you know, the alarm goes off, boom, up out of bed and get yourself moving. If you hit that snooze alarm, you're dead meat, or at least vulnerable, you know, either to a kind of slothfulness or a slothfulness that then leads to particular sins, you know, again, because there's a vulnerability there in that kind of slumber. Did I see your hand? Yes.
Yeah, so this is actually something I wonder about a lot. Because of the growing number of people living alone, even if you're not intentional or like intending to be permanently single, what do you do about meals when you live alone? Because I mean, I think like I think the vast majority of people who live alone probably like watch television while they eat their meals. And it's like, you know, do you, for a while I was like, oh, well, my home should be like a little monastery, so I would listen to these like holy podcasts during dinner to like give myself the monastic feel of there being a reader. And I'm always just kind of wondering, like, do you accept like total silence at meals as a part of the vocation of being single? Do you try to do something like read or have something like you're listening to, because it just feels like there's no order to enter into. It's just sort of this thing that there's not really any guidance about.
Well, I think there is an order to enter into. I think there has to be the discipline to create it, to create a role. And why not use the monastic life as a model? You know, there's a kind of wisdom of centuries of experience there that can teach us how it is that we would, you know, bring a kind of discipline and order to our day-to-day life. And so if one were single, why not to do exactly what you said, listen to a podcast on a spiritual subject or an audio book on a spiritual reading, or read yourself. And the same thing even when one is preparing one's meal. Often when you go to a monastery retreat house, sometimes they will do that. They'll put on either chant, or they'll put on a tape of some spiritual conference for those who are having the meal. And so it seems to me that actually would be a good idea, not allowing oneself then to fall into that trap of saying, well, okay, I'm alone here, you know, I'll take this time to entertain myself, so I'll put something on Netflix. It's just a show, and it's perfectly timed. It's 45 minutes for a meal, you know, and so I can do that. It's no big deal. And I think Isaac is saying, well, actually, it is an important time of one's day. And not to shame. I mean, I'm not trying to shame or anything like that. If you watch Netflix,
yeah. On the podcast, on right. The TV, so, and then you're like, ooh, just one more episode.
Yeah,
I'll get
that's
seconds.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like, they're terrible about that. They throw up the next episode, you know.
It all starts off
the next episode. Yeah, well, yeah.
Beginning in 5 seconds.
That's right. So, you know, to be conscious about this, you know, to say, you know, these are the moments that we often, again, take for granted. And there's not one moment in our life. This is a beautiful thing about the monastic writings, is that they came to know the mind and the heart very well. And even sort of the tricks that we play on ourselves and how we will rationalize so easily. And I think that's why in this section as well, that, you know, that we before the Lord earnestly acknowledge our weakness and unskillfulness before the subtlety of conceit, that we, in humbling ourselves and acknowledging how we do fall into that kind of rationalization or making those moments in our mind nothing, you know, that there, that's not, this is sort of downtime even from God or from the spiritual life, where I can sort of let loose and relax, you know, kind of thing. And so the only way through this is to humbly acknowledge that, okay, you know, I can't even see the subtlety of my own thoughts that would lead me astray here. How easily, you know, I'm tempted to, you know, watch an episode or watch another one and, you know, to give myself that path. And, you know, at that moment, it might not have any direct impact upon us. And I think this is where we often will be tripped up, because you could do something like that repeatedly, even over the course of months, and not have it seem to have any effect upon you. You know, watching a show or a couple shows during dinner and have that go on and even feel refreshed or sort of entertained by it. But there is a kind of dulling spiritually that takes place when we do that over a prolonged period of time, because we get used to living in that distraction rather than living in that attentiveness to God. And we do it because it's easier, and you know, we can let go of that attentiveness for a period of time and escape reality. And basically is what we're doing.
I think the hardest thing, and just like from experience, is like kind of going into that, losing that attentiveness for a time, and then trying to return only to find that you've sort of lost your taste for the, you know, the better way. And it's so frustrating every time to come back to what the Father said all the time, which is like, it holy, like the life of, you know, life in God is an acquired taste. It's not like something easy, or else we would just be able to do it naturally. And so to kind of fall out of it.
Well, I think we're getting a sense, too, we're sort of circling around why something like vigils would be seen in the way that they are by Isaac and the other fathers. When we can circle around this, which is more in our grasp, to say that a kind of consistency there and attentiveness during these times where we're more vulnerable bears fruit over time, and we see that we can be more attentive to at our other times of prayer. We're less distracted. We're able to enter into our prayer more swiftly because we haven't let our minds just wander. And so circling around that, then we can begin to understand a little bit more why that attentiveness and prolonged attentiveness during the night would then help us be more attentive throughout the course of the day on a spiritual level, where we've been disciplined there at a time when the world typically isn't, you know, or that we are oblivious to what's going on around us, you know, to take that time and allow it to be focused upon God in a radically intensive kind of way is going to change the shape of our day as a whole. Now, this doesn't mean that one doesn't, you know, oftentimes in monasteries they'll have, you know, a break later in the day where there can be a little siesta to, you know, get a little extra rest if they are irregularly doing this practice, so they don't do it indiscriminately. But again, it takes, trust comes from the experience of it and seeing the fruit of it over time. In the same way of developing this role around the meals, I think the trust in the value of that comes over time when you begin to see the fruit of it in your day-to-day life. You're more focused and you're more of an even keel, even on an emotional level, because you're rooted more and more in the peace of the kingdom. And so you aren't, you know, even if the days are difficult, you're not having these radical ups and downs because you're focused upon God. And, you know, we almost like to have those radical ups and downs. You know, even the things that we watch, you know, those dramatic, you know, romance kind of things, you know, where people come out, you know, sort of weep and, you know, it makes them feel like crap. But they watch, you know, these things anyways, you know, because, you know, it sort of, I don't know if it makes them feel better about their own life. You know, they watch some sad romance and then, you know, then try to go to bed after or that, or try to pray after that. It's impossible. Dan?
So maybe it's the, it's partly Isaac and part of this conversation. It's just making, like, to me it sounds like stirring you out of comfort, you know, like to at least, or maybe I'm just like interpreting it my own way, like the whole, all these touch points, like night vigils. I mean, that's the whole point, like sleeping and you're like, you know, you're trying to get comfortable so you can sleep, but breaking the night is like breaking you out of that comfort and the whole, I don't know, it just seems like it's a recurring, something about this is making me think about that, is that it seems like the central thing is that he's trying to break, or he's telling you basically, break yourself out of that comfort of your circumstances.
But not as an end in itself. And I think that's for us, we want to hold on to that. You know, because like in analysis, you know, the whole free association thing, where you allow sort of this sustained attention to what's going on in your thoughts, that creates a certain kind of tension, you know, to be aware of those things and not to just let them pass by. You know, Freud stole that from the Desert Fathers. I mean, they were really the first to understand that the thoughts were so important and being attentive to them and their meaning on multiple levels. And so it does throw us out of a comfort zone. It creates kind of tension when we allow ourselves to see those things and that those moments do have meaning for us. And those thoughts do have meaning and they point us to different things about what's going on within the mind and the heart. But ultimately, it leads to a greater freedom for us. Our awareness of that truth allows us then to establish a different habit of mind that is directed toward God. And so even, you know, analysis is trying to understand a kind of internal narrative that develops historically for a person that often then gives rise to depression or anxiety, you know, because we have certain defenses that come into play through our formation. And with those defenses go certain thoughts in order that we can contain that which is stressful to us. And so by seeing that narrative over time and understanding it, gradually a new narrative can come into play that allows for more healthy defenses to come in and into practice and to be used that aren't so costly to the individual and don't, you know, foster a kind of anxiety or depression within them. It allows that, you know, to be healed on a certain level. But that pales in comparison, we have to understand, in comparison to what the fathers teach us, because it's not something that's abstracted from our identity in Christ and our relationship with God. You know, our attentiveness to these thoughts and the patterns of our behavior and the narrative that's going on within allows for a different habit of mind and heart to be established that is directed toward God. And so this constant movement toward God allows us to enter more and more deeply into that relationship and so more and more deeply into the peace of the kingdom. So we began to find Isaac, you know, in the page even that I took you to here, speaking of, it's a cause of delight, gladden, rejoice. It cleanses the soul, that there's a kind of freedom, joy, invincible peace that it establishes within the human heart. Because we're no longer living for ourselves and we're no longer living in a way that's abstracted from God, but always tending and moving towards Him. And so this is how we even understand repentance. You know, it's moving toward God. It's not a single moment of repenting of a particular sin, but a constant movement to He who is the beginning and end of all things for us. And that offers us something, you know, far greater than, you know, the greater capacity to work or to enter into relationships. This allows us to enter into the very life of God and to be transformed by that reality and by that relationship. So Isaac's, you know, holding, and the fathers hold out to us, again, an invincible peace and joy and deification, a share in the very life of God. Whereas the most our world holds out to us is a kind of episodic peace at best, or a baseline kind of experience of self that is endurable, you know. That was basically Freud's vision, you know, that we get to a point of an acceptable level of unhappiness. You know, that was the, you know, it's hardly, you know, makes you want to sort of jump into this practice. You know, he had extremely modest, extremely modest sense of the goals and the ability of something like therapy to really help us. We get to a livable point of unhappiness, you know. And for me, that's not enough. And I think for all of us, I think we have this greater sense that we're meant for something far more. And yet we are more than often willing to sort of accept the paltry alms, if you will, that the world throws into our laps. Or we're desperately searching for something to fill us. You know, the next thing that comes around the corner, the next kind of therapy or the next kind of medicine, whatever it might be that will be able to lift us out of that, radically change our life. And even in the secular culture, fasting, you know, this intermittent fasting, you know, people see the psychological and the physiological effects of that. And so it becomes all the rage, you know, that this is a healthy kind pattern of living and eating. And, you know, it's like, we should say, duh, you know, that we have, 1,500 years, you know, telling us that it's just doesn't lead to simply good health. You know, these monks lived to like 120 and doesn't lead simply to, you know, freedom from depression or whatever it might be, but it leads to something far greater and holds out a hope for us that's far greater, so that even in the midst of the crosses and the trials of day-to-day life, we know that we do not live that in isolation. I think one of the greatest struggles for people in our day is exactly that, feeling alone, feeling isolated in their struggles. And that makes everything worse. There's a sense of disconnection from each other. And then the worst one is the sense of disconnect from God. And we've talked about this before, you know, the kind of existential depression and anxiety that brings to a person, you know, of being disconnected from He who created us, He who loves us, and in whom we find the deepest sense of our identity as human beings. You know, what do we think is going to happen to us as human beings when we separate ourselves from that reality? You know, we become frenetic in our activities, desperate, you know, to fill our lives or to find something in our lives that's going to fill that void. But nothing can fill that void because it's an infinite kind of thing. We've been created for God. And as Augustine says, our hearts are restless till they rest in Thee. So basically he's telling us there's nothing in this world that's going to fill that sense of emptiness or aloneness or isolation except God Himself. And often we have to get to that point where we experience, you know, the lowliness of that, you know, to be really humbled by that before, you know, we turn to Him and embrace Him in the way that He desires. Yes.
Back to the thoughts. How do we tell the difference between the thoughts that we're supposed to focus on and analyze the thoughts that we want to sort of take away from our minds by saying the Jesus prayer.
Well,
are we able to actually analyze these thoughts ourselves?
I don't think the fathers were so focused upon analyzing. I think that has become our way of pulling apart things to understand them, because we feel that in understanding them, then we're going to be able to control them. And on some level, that bears a certain fruit for us, at least enough that we cling to that idea. But I think their sense was that it was a movement from the multiplicity of those thoughts to simplicity onto God is where the deepest healing comes from. It's in the experience of that intimacy that we experience healing from at the hand of the divine physician. So it's not so much analyzing and pulling apart our thoughts. We don't engage in the Jesus prayer in order to even discern what the thoughts might be, because on some level we could be deluded there, or we can just become distracted with the focus on the particular thoughts and wrestling with them. Whereas most of the fathers tell us, just allow the prayer to carry you forward to God. Keep your eyes on the beloved. The thoughts are like, you know, individuals in a room between you and the beloved. There's all this movement. You keep your eyes focused upon the beloved. And that's where we're kept from falling into, you know, delusion and being led astray. You know, there's some contemporary elders that say, leave sin alone, you know, or leave the demons alone, you know, because the moment that you focus upon those things too much, is your focus is off of where it needs to be, on God. And so you might be wrestling, expending a lot of energy trying to understand or control those things, whereas you would experience greater freedom by just allowing yourself to be focused upon the beloved and captivated with him. And so that's why they never let go of the word desire, you know, because it's desire that draws us forward to the one alone who can complete us and fill us. And if we sort of make ourselves stoics, try to strip ourselves of all desire, thinking that in doing that we free ourselves from sin, we also free ourselves from the desire for God and from the capacity to love and be loved.
But every part of life is different. The monastics had a different kind of life.
Mm-hmm.
And we in the world have to change. I know my life has changed now that I'm living alone and I'm not raising 12 children. But now I wake up to classical music every morning.
12 children, that's all you had?
And then after that is my prayer life.
Yeah.
And then after, I'm mm-hmm. showering and listening mm-hmm. to classical music.
Right.
And then I pray.
Uh-huh.
And then I busy myself. But I think in every part of our lives, if you don't busy yourself, you're looking around thinking you're lonely, you don't know what to do. But if you keep busy thinking of all these things you're going to do, and I just ordered four of these programs from that learning series.
Right.
And If you don't busy yourself and keep busy and keep learning.
Well, I understand what you're saying. You know, avoiding a kind of idleness avoids us from being drawn into sadness or despair or a sense
yes.
of isolation. But the fathers aren't talking about busyness. You know, what they're talking about is, you know, a constant and unceasing mindfulness of God that allows us to be focused and busy about the work of our Father and engaged with him. This is where true freedom comes from. And I think the busyness that you talk about that keeps you from idleness has become in our world a kind of frenetic activity that really leads us to be oblivious to the fullness of reality, who is God. We become so busy that we become abstracted even from ourselves and what's going on what's going on within. And so the Desert Fathers, I think, would tell us the truth is the truth. And so even if our station is different in life, the monastic literature and what it teaches us still holds true for us. And so the struggle that goes on within, the reality of what goes on with our thoughts, you know, this has to be incorporated into our life, whatever that station might be. You're right, that we go through different periods in our life and how we live that and how we respond to the realities and responsibilities we have require us to do that. But it has to be guided through a particular role of life, an understanding of the human person. And what I love about the Eastern Fathers and the monastic writers is that they have a very clear anthropology. It's consistent. There's a kind of homogeneity in their writing over the course of 1,500 years that allows me to have enormous confidence in it. Because, you know, throughout all these centuries, here are people seeking to live their life to the fullness, focused upon God in the fullest way possible. And so it's for us to take hold of this wisdom and incorporate it in our life. And so we might have to do that, you know, within our particular station. But being mindful of God throughout the course of the day is even more important, I think, for a person living in the world, precisely because of the profound amount of distraction that faces us. So we almost have to have a greater vigilance. Like, they cut out a whole slew of things that could lead them astray from God by going into the desert. You know, because, you know, all of a sudden they lived in silence, they had this radical simplicity, you know, but we're surrounded by all these things that in these very subtle ways can pull us away from God. And we can find ways, you know, to maintain a feeling of religiosity that really isn't bringing us closer to God or bringing about a deeper conversion of mind and heart. You know, we become tasters of the spiritual traditions, like we're at a banquet table and we pick this and that and that. But, you know, we often don't walk away from that table, you know, really satisfied or well nourished, you know, because we're just picking and choosing what we want. Tonight we were reading at dinner, you know, the doctors of the church, and Isidore of Seville was one of the early ones who defined he was focused on etymology. He was like an encyclopedist, you know, he gathered information of all these subjects, it was secular and sacred, but heresy is, you know, to choose for oneself what one is going to believe. And I think oftentimes in modern culture, we're heretics because we're constantly choosing for ourselves, picking and choosing for ourselves what we're going to believe. Even as Catholics, when we know, you know, that we are part of a living tradition and we're rooted in that and we believe in a revealed religion and a living faith that we have for us that has existed over 2,000 years that we enter into and allow to form and shape the mind and the heart. But we sort of live our lives basically as practical heretics. We sort of pick and choose what we're going to believe and embrace and how we're going to live our lives. So we don't often live in like this full sense of obedience, you know, ab adere, you know, where we are listening in a docile way to the truth that is revealed to us in the person of Christ, in the liturgy, in the scriptures, and from the church herself. And we're sort of trained to think that way. We're taught to basically be heretics, you know.
It's a difficult world mm-hmm. when you think of yeah. all the choices, too many choices.
Well, the truth is what you make it. I think that's what most people are taught today. Yeah, that's right. Yes, Carol.
What you were saying reminded me a lot of Simeon and Anna. she was only married for 7 years, and then she lived practically in the temple until she was 84. Mm-hmm. And she found that desert in the temple, and that's how she was able to recognize when Jesus arrived.
Right.
And it's like, wow, you know, it took all of that for her, all of that silence and all of that prayer and all of that fasting to recognize him. No wonder so many of us miss him, because we're not living that radical attentiveness to God like she did.
Right.
And she's mentioned so little, you know.
I know.
I mean, because Simeon's the one that does all the action, but she's the one who's in the background telling everybody, this is
I've often thought that
him.
Too.
Yeah.
She's often ignored in that story. You know, we hear about Simeon, but she's often left out of the story altogether. And that fasting and praying for all of those years and recognizing, and those who were religious, you know, who sort of focused on, you know, religiosity in a particular kind of way, were not even, you know, they weren't able to see him, but they, even though they knew, say, for example, when Herod calls them, you know, where is the king of the Jews to be born? They knew of the prophecies, you know, that he was to be born in Bethlehem. And, you know, but did they go with when the Magi came? You know, did it come into their mind? Well, you know, here are these Gentiles, you know, who are coming, you know, have heard of this, you know, birth of this new child, they've seen the signs of it and are asking about it. They know the prophecy, and, you know, it doesn't come into their mind to go search for themselves, and yet they join in support with a murderer, with Herod, who then, a short time later, murders all, you know, the boys under 2 years old. It's a horrendous kind of betrayal of God, but a betrayal of the truth. I mean, we can sort of look at what's going on, even contemporary, in a contemporary way. What, you know, what went on there now has happened again in the church. It sort of repeated itself, and for the exact same kind of reasons. A blindness to God, a pride that leads into delusion of the most frightening sort that we've seen. And so I thank God, you know, for the Desert Fathers. I mean, if they create this kind of tension for us, thanks be to God. You know, if they make us uncomfortable with our normal way of thinking about things and the comfortable way of thinking about things. Because at least if we're made uncomfortable, we're, you know, examining our lives in some measure. So I've never been afraid in this group when people say, you know, I just really feel uncomfortable with this, or, you know, I feel agitated by it, or I don't get it. You know, okay. You know, it's not a bad thing to walk away a little confused and thinking about things. I think we've had enough of being sort of spoon-fed baby food, you know, over, you know, a couple of generations, you know, to be fed upon. And we are. I mean, this is solid food, and there's something very challenging about it. And we have to be willing to allow ourselves to experience that tension, that internal tension, and remain with it, not be afraid of it, allow it to reveal the truth that it's speaking to us. So the group will be even smaller next time. What time is it here? We're 8:33, and I'm sorry, folks, we only got through two paragraphs tonight. We're not ever going to finish this. I'm not doing it on purpose, I promise. At least not consciously. Okay, let's close with the prayer. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. The Lord be with you. Amen. May God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Go in peace. Thank you so much. You all make this such an enjoyable experience for me.